This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
What he's very good at is being an opposition politician, being sort of entertaining and provocative at the same time, but actually settling down and saying, OK, we've got, you know, three choices before us, all of them bad. Which of them is the least bad? That's not his game at all. And I think he'd be quite scared at the prospect that he'd got his hands on the levers of power. And the day Nigel Farage says, I'm going to pass up this opportunity to be popular in the short term or to make a headline in the short term, is the day I'll start thinking he's preparing for government. But he's not started doing that yet.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, Reform UK made their committee debut in the council chamber. We find out more than a fifth of the working population in Kent aren't actually working. And guess what? Medway Council has a local plan. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter for Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And standing in for Nikki this week is news editor Sean Delaney, who will be taking the temperature up at Westminster.
Hello.
And this week's special guest is former Ashford MP and Deputy Prime Minister in Theresa May's government, Damian Green, as he reflects on a year away from the Palace of Westminster. First of all, Rob, what have you been looking at in Medway?
Well, it's finally arrived. Medway Council's local plan, which sets out allocations for housing and infrastructure for the next 15 years. The plans were published on June 20th, but the meeting to discuss them and decide whether they would go out for public consultation was on June 27th, where there were 31 votes in support of the draft plan and 24 votes against. But not before some pretty robust debate, which saw accusations of betrayal and of insufficient plans.
Oh, do tell all.
So the most controversial bit is Chatham Docks, which, after a long saga, will be designated for residential-led development. Lots of workers from the docks were sitting in the public gallery and they cheered speakers who criticised the plans and booed those who supported them. Large areas of the Capstone Valley, which has previously seen planning applications approved, has also been allocated for residential development. On the Hoo Peninsula, a pretty significant change has seen the amount of land allocated for housing clumped together around Hoos and Werburgh rather than spread out across all the villages and towns, and who will see employment land and community centres included, as well as a supermarket. A very unpopular change in Strood is that a section of Greenbelt land, which has previously fended off development, will be allocated for housing as it borders Gravesham Council's area, and the neighbouring authority, who is also bringing together its own local plan, has earmarked their side of the border for housing too. This means the Greenbelt land can now be seen as the new Greybelt category. There are also concerns Gravesham could apply to use that section of land in Medway to meet its own housing needs, so will be built on even if Medway decided not to. Finally, the Medway City Estate is also to be changed from an enterprise zone, which it has been since the 1980s, into an opportunity zone, and we'll see redevelopment into partially for homes, as well as using part of it as a floodplain for climate change, and rising tide levels are an increasing issue.
Yeah, you mentioned a robust debate. What was that all about?
So it largely centred around the fact that the Labour group previously supported the Save Chatham Docks campaign and opposed housing for the site before they won the council in May 2023. But there were also criticisms that the plans didn't lead with infrastructure, saying it's mostly reliant on developer contributions, which can be weaselled out of. On Chatham Docks, Council Leader Vince Maple did hit back at accusations he had let the workers down, as he brought out a letter from ArcelorMittal Kent Wire, who occupy part of the site, from 2021, where they said they were preparing a bid to buy the land from the current landowner, Peel Waters. However, he said, when he checked earlier that day, no bid had ever been made, so it was ArcelorMittal who had let down their workers by not following through. This was met with calls of rubbish from the audience. In the end, all Labour members, apart from Councillor Stephen Hubbard, who did not attend the meeting because he had been told comments he had made saying he would not support a plan with the Strood Greenbelt changes were classed as predetermination, voted for, as did Independent Councillor Chris Spalding, while the Tories, Independent Group and Reform UK councillors voted against. The draft plan is now out for public consultation until August 11th. So, Simon, I hear Kent County Council is back up and running at long last this week.
Yeah, it seems like a long, long time now. Yes, we had one of the first of the big cabinet committee sitting this week, and the first since Reform UK took control of the county a couple of months ago.
So how was it for the members on their first day proper?
Well, it was the Growth, Economic Development and Communities Committee on Tuesday morning, which is a pretty standard committee, but an important one all the same. And I think a lot of people were predicting it would be an absolute shambles, but I think most agreed at the end that the Reform UK lot actually sort of acquitted themselves pretty well in the chamber. And there was a very interesting nugget in the papers for that particular meeting. According to them, 21% of the working age population are currently economically inactive. This equates to an enormous 204,000 people in Kent, and 27% of those are out of work due to long-term health problems.
So what's driving these problems?
Well, The papers note that the contributing factors include long-term sickness and disability, low levels of educational attainment, caring duties, access to secure quality work, and mismatches between vacancies and suitable skill sets. But that it means that in some parts of the county there are jobs, but not the people with the skills to do them. Or there may be other parts of the county where people have the skills, but not the jobs for them to do. And it may well get worse as employers seem hesitant to hire these days because of the changes to the national insurance contributions and the minimum wage. And there's another scenario where there might be an older person who requires care from a family member who ends up having to leave work to look after them, so that person becomes inactive as well.
What else does the report say?
The report is a background document to what is called, snappily, the Get Kent and Medway Working Plan, required by central government and funded by central government, and it hopes to align it with current work aimed at reducing health inequalities in places like Swale, Canterbury, Thanet, Dover, Fuxenhithe and Ashford. It also says that young people who are not in education, employment or training, the so-called NEETs, account for about 1,600 of the total, or 4.3%. And in Kent, 7.2% of the working age cohort have no qualifications at all. So it's not a very positive picture that the report paints. Sean, what's caught your eye up in Westminster this week?
Well, this week's big news from Westminster saw Sir Keir Starmer falls into a chaotic climb down over his controversial welfare reform bill. It limped through, but many MPs, several Labour members included, were left scratching their heads as to what they'd actually achieved. That's because the government's initial plan changes to the eligibility criteria for disabled benefits for all new claimants, a central plank of the system overhaul, has been placed on hold pending the outcome of a review. In total, 49 Labour MPs voted against the cuts. None were members from Kent, but Dartford's Jim Dixon raised his concerns to the Work and Pension Secretary in the Commons. He referenced a number of in-depth conversations he had been having with people here in his constituency who are living with disabilities who fear a two-tier benefit system after it's introduced. He said he'd heard again and again how poor the health service had been at helping disabled people to manage their conditions. But Work and Pensions Minister Liz Kendall responded to his concern and said that the health service can certainly do more, and she was working with the Health Secretary on plans to get people back to health and back to work, and it's so important. She said they were essentially two sides of the same coin and they need to end these false divides to ensure people fulfil their ambitions. But Tory Faversham and Mid-Kent MP Helen Whateley was not convinced. She slammed the government's bill and termed it a rushed and chaotic compromise that is not reform in any sense of the word. In her view, the bill is woefully unambitious about savings, conspicuously lacking in compassion, and achieves no meaningful change of a system we all know is broken. But again, the relevant minister responded to these concerns and said that Miss Whateley had some chutzpah to talk about a two-tier system, given that her government's failed record on the same programme. She argued the new Labour government are putting in place real reforms based on its values, which ultimately are fair for those who need support and for taxpayers.
Okay, thank you, Sean.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
A year ago, pretty much to the day, the Conservative Party was heavily beaten at the general election. There were many big-name casualties in Kent, and perhaps none bigger than the MP for Ashford for nearly three decades, Damian Green. And here to reflect on life away from Westminster politics is Damian. Damian, welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Thank you.
You know, I was there the night you lost your seat. You didn't seem entirely surprised that Reform UK split the right of centre vote and allowed Labour's Sojan Joseph in. What was going through your mind when you watched the ballot papers pile up and they were not in your favour?
Well, it was a combination of watching them pile up and also listening to all the national results. It was clear that the result was at the worst end, that's below the worst end of anyone's expectations. And so, as you say, I wasn't particularly surprised. I could tell for some hours before that this was likely to happen. And so, you know, I was obviously sorry to lose. I was sorry for all the people who'd worked really hard for me. And also I was feeling that, you know, the Conservative Party was in a worse state than I could ever remember it. Even when, if you remember, I was first elected in 97, which was the previous worst ever result to the Conservative Party. So my period in Parliament was bookended by the two worst results in Conservative Party's history.
You know, once you suddenly find yourself as a former member of Parliament, you know, what happens next? What are the nuts and bolts? I think you said to me the other day, you know, weirdly, you don't wake up with nothing to do.
Well, no, you'd think that suddenly, as you say, there's nothing to do. But actually, in the first few days, because it all has to happen so quickly, you're incredibly busy. You know, you've got to get out of your office within 4 or 5 days because they need it for one of the new MPs. So there's a huge amount of moving to do. If you hadn't planned to leave, then you've got a whole office to clear. And also, you know, I had 5 members of staff, all of whom were rendered instantly unemployed as well. So, you know, you obviously have to look after them as well and see what you can do to help them and, you know, sort out all the redundancy arrangements and stuff like that. So for the first few weeks, it is unbelievably busy.
And all the time sort of tinged with a certain amount of sadness and change. I mean, you were there for 27 years. You that's a long time for most parliamentarians.
Yeah, I mean, you become obviously institutionalised, and so the rhythm of your life changes completely. In that, you know, there is no, you have to create the new rhythm, if you like. And it's a very ordered society. It is. I mean, it's reminded me all the way through that it's a bit like school. It's the only time in your life where you're governed by bells. If the bell goes, you have to do something.
Yeah, yeah.
First time the first time it happened, I thought this is slightly weird. I haven't had this since I was at school. But yeah, you know, like any institution, you get used to it. You get used to the weird hours. And the sort of constant demands. And of course, all of that goes. And while, you know, there are obviously huge regrets involved in things that you miss, you know, there are parts of it, like sort of getting your own time back, when you settle down and get over it, you don't miss.
So, yeah, that's when you've had a little time to reflect. I mean, was there a little bit of bitterness towards, say, Reform UK, you know, because effectively they stood in seats they knew they weren't going to win, but they knew they would also split the vote. I mean, do you feel any, or do you just accept that that's democracy and you fell in that way?
Well, that's politics. I mean, it's you know, democratic politics is a rough game if you take part. You know, you either win or you don't. It's pretty binary. And yeah, we could all see what was happening. You know, the Conservative Party spent the entire election campaign telling people vote Reform, get Starmer. And they ignored that, or, you know, chose to say we don't care. We're so keen to get rid of the Conservatives. We don't care if we get Starmer instead. And I met somebody the day before the election, the last day of the election campaign. I was out in Wye, and a Reformer out campaigning there as well. And a lady came up to me who, I'm guessing, but I would guess she had never before voted anything other than Conservative. And she said to me cheerfully, "Well, of course we have to vote Reform this time, but I hope we don't lose you." And that's the point where you feel control. Be polite, be polite, because really, you know exactly. Well, if you don't know, you clearly don't know exactly what you're doing. But I know exactly what you're doing, and indeed, you know, I was proved right that she was indeed about to lose me, as she put it. But hey, as I say, that's politics. And if you go into it thinking you've got a job for life, then you're in for a severe disappointment.
But there was a lot of people, a lot of Conservative MPs, but like yourself, you know, sitting on 20,000-odd majorities, you know, who left us. It was Damien Collins, 25,000 or 21,000, whatever it was. And then you got other ones, the two Helens, Helen Grant and Helen Whately, who just get in by the skin of their teeth. I mean, they could just as easily have lost them, and the Conservatives would have been down to, you know, a mere handful in Kent.
Yeah, I mean, as happened in some other counties. Frankly, my view is well done, everyone who hang on, including, you know, Helen Whately and Helen Grant. They did very well, because the tide, boy, was the tide going out on us. and to, you know, to survive in those circumstances is pretty impressive. But that's the thing. It's like it's like the sea. It's a good metaphor, really, that there are times where the tide comes in or goes out so much that it doesn't matter what any individual can do. You get swept along with it.
Mm. You've been away from the Palace of Westminster for a year now. Are there any aspects? I mean, apart from the sort of the day to day and the institutionalism of it all, but are there any aspects of the job that you actually miss as an MP?
Yeah, I mean, I miss the constituency involvement quite a lot because I love all that. I liked, in a sense, it's sort of being nosy. I liked being able to poke around people's businesses and visit schools and, you know, get involved in local campaigns and so on. All of that was quite satisfying. And also some of the individual stuff, you know, the things that got me most riled up tended to be individual injustices to people who have been badly treated by one bit or other of the system. And actually solving those problems, genuinely, you could do something that would transform someone's life, and that's tremendously satisfying.
Yeah.
So I miss that more than I miss the sort of, I don't know, the back and forth of Parliament and, you know, debate in the chambers and so on. I mean, yeah, that's obviously the high profile bit of politics, and I enjoyed all that as well. But as I say, if you ask me what I really miss, it is strangely constituency work, which I know a lot of MPs, you know, heave a sigh and do it out of a sense of duty more than anything else. But I actually rather enjoyed it.
So what are you up to these days? You're chair of the Social Care Foundation, something which is going to become very important in the next few years and has already become pretty important, I guess. Tell us what the Social Care Foundation does.
It's a think tank that was sort of sitting around doing not very much, and they've asked me to take it over. And I want to make sure that social care, which was a policy area I was really interested in my last few years in Parliament, continues to resonate in the sort of mix of political issues, because successive governments of all parties have kicked the can down the road. And I think what's happening in the sector is a sort of gradual, almost inexorable decline in quality. The sector, you know, the people who work in it do brilliantly at coping with greater demand and no greater resources year after year. They do very, very well at it. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that disguises what I think could be a real crisis. And I desperately hope that we find a decent, stable solution to both funding and organisation of it before we have to in a hurry, because there has been some horrible crisis where a lot of very vulnerable people have been turned out in the street or something like that, and it becomes a huge national headline issue. I would very much like the system to get its act together before that. And, you know, I fear with every year that passes, that crisis will become more likely.
Mm. Funnily enough, I was just reading today some council papers that go before the Adult Social Care Committee at KCC next week, and it says the people who are going to need long-term nursing care, as opposed to residential care, long-term nursing care between now, and this is in Kent, between now and 2030 is going to rise by 56.68%. And the number of people that are going to require long-term residential care is going to go up by more than 30%. These are, frankly, staggering statistics.
Well, they're eye-opening statistics, but they're not staggering because they're just demographics. Mm. You know, we know how many 70-year-olds there are now, so we know in 10 years' time, roughly speaking, how many 80-year-olds there are going to be. And we know what percentage of 80-year-olds will require some kind of, as you say, nursing care or just residential care. And that's probably not going to change very much in a decade, because whatever medical advances we make probably won't change those statistics very much. So in a sense, this is my point. This is a it might be a slow motion crisis, but it's entirely predictable that it will get worse and more intense because of the demographics.
But why aren't governments funding councils properly to look after these people?
The answer is because in the end, it involves taking more money off people, and people are already feeling overtaxed, and successive governments have not wanted to confront people with the unpleasant thought that if you want decent, high quality social care, we're going to have to pay for it somehow. Mm. And how you pay for it has become the big arguing point. As you say, we fund it through councils at the moment. I think it's very questionable whether we should continue to do that. I think the danger is that Kent will end up as a provider of social care with, you know, a couple of libraries and maybe a service to repair potholes on the end of it, and that will be about it. And I don't think that's what we want from local government. I personally think.
Which sort of funding model would you favour? Would you be looking at something like, you know, what became known as the dementia tax, or would you want to sort of, you know, make people sell their own homes or their assets in order to pay for it? I mean, how would you fund this?
I wouldn't want people to sell their own homes, but I do think those who can afford it could take some more individual responsibility. I'm attracted to an insurance type of model where basically you take out an insurance policy against the possibility that you will need expensive social care towards the end of your life. And there will always be some people who will required to be supported by the state because they haven't got any assets, haven't got any money. But you know, anyone who is a homeowner, if you said, right, if you know, everyone who's a homeowner put a percentage of that into an insurance policy, then you would fund social care better. Mm-hmm. And also, because you need to get something for something, you would have peace of mind. You wouldn't worry about how am I going to pay for this, or am I going to become a burden on my children, or am I going to have to sell my home and lose my whole inheritance from it. I think a sort of long-term approach to it, maybe as much as we do with pensions, would be sensible. And people say, well, what happens, you know, if you've got this insurance policy and you never cash it in, that you die in a car crash on your 70th birthday or something like that. Well, okay, you've as it were wasted that money, but you know, we all pay car insurance every year, we all pay house insurance every year, and I hope never to claim on either of those policies. I hope, in a sense, that's, you know, I'll go through my life wasting money on that, because I'd rather not have a car accident, I'd rather not have my house burgled. So, you know, that's the, you know, the point of insurance is, A, it gives you peace of mind, B, it helps you in an emergency, but C, you can buy a lot more. If people collectively insure, then you have enough money going around the system that you can afford to help people. So I'm conscious I'm doing it very quickly for the sake of this podcast, and there are lots of people who you know, you could pick holes in that. But I do think we need some kind of radical solution, because I do know that if we carry on doing what we're doing, where the government bungs a bit of money to local authorities every year to paper over the cracks, then we will end up with a system that quietly creaks away and gets a bit worse at the margins every year. And I don't think either people, working age people with disabilities or older people who need help, should be treated like that.
One can understand there being a bit of a lull after the general election, but you know, Labour are doing so badly and Reform appears to be filling the void as well. Is there any way that the Tories can catch Reform?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think as you know, let's see what Reform do with Kent County Council, for example, and the other county councils that they run, because so far it's not been a very impressive performance. I think inevitably, you know, the Conservative Party was kicked out big time a year ago, and so people are not going to be turning back to it yet in very large numbers. And you know, Kemi Badenoch is right about that. I think, you know, the route back, I think there's a gap in the market now for, if you like, an old-fashioned responsible Conservative Party that says you've got to base everything on a strong economy, and to do that you need strong public finances. You know, the government needs to live within its means. Both the Labour Party is failing to persuade its own backbenchers to do that, literally as we record this podcast. There's a massive Labour rebellion going on, so I think the Labour Party is always going to struggle with that. Reform are at the stage of promising everyone, you know, bread and circuses and whatever you want, and saying, oh, and we'll cut taxes as well, which is wholly unrealistic. And I think people will see through that over the course of the next few years. So, as I say, there's a gap in the market for traditional Conservative virtues of, you know, live within your means, spend what you can, you know, be strong on defence and policing and law and order and all of that. And that is an attractive proposition, given the many problems of the country at the moment, but at the moment people are not predisposed to listen. And you know, it's Kemi Badenoch and all my colleagues, my former colleagues in Parliament's job to make sure that sort of overall message can be put across in a vivid way with individual policies that strike home with people, but which are realistic. And yeah, you know, and that's the job for the next 3 years.
Kemi Badenoch, can she survive till the next election, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if changing your leader was the solution to your problems, then the Conservative Party should be 20 points ahead in the polls, not 20 points behind, because we change our leader with far too great regularity. And I don't think people will think we're particularly serious if we go through all of that again.
Reform UK appears to be using its leadership of Kent County Council as a sort of a testbed for national government, or at least that's the way it's being interpreted and reported. Do you think Nigel Farage is preparing for government?
Well, I think he can read opinion polls as well, so he must have thought there's a possibility. I've seen people who know him better than I, indeed, Fraser Nelson, the very good, now he's now working for The Times, used to edit The Spectator, has done a documentary.
Yeah,
about
I saw it. Yeah.
And Fraser's conclusion is that Nigel Farage is scared stiff at the prospect that he might be Prime Minister. That I think somewhere deep down he knows his own virtues and faults, and what he's very good at is being an opposition politician, being sort of entertaining and provocative at the same time, but actually settling down and saying, okay, we've got three choices before us, all of them bad, which of them is the least bad, which is quite often what you're doing in government. That's not his game at all, and I think he'd be quite scared at the prospect that he'd got his hands on the levers of power. So the day Nigel Farage says, I'm going to pass up this opportunity to be popular in the short term or to make a headline in the short term, is the day I'll start thinking he's preparing for government, but he's not started doing that yet.
Do you know Nigel?
Well, I've met him a few times, yeah. I mean, I've done Question Time with him. I've met him at sort of social events and things like that. So, he's perfectly good company on a one-to-one basis. I just don't agree with his politics.
Yeah. And you don't think he's got the wherewithal and the necessary sort of characteristics to be a Prime Minister?
No, I don't. I think, as I say, he's a very effective sort of gadfly opposition politician. And he is, I will absolutely get that he is cruising a tide of massive public discontent with the way things are in this country. And they spent years blaming the Conservative Party for that. They've instantly switched to blaming the Labour Party for that. But they haven't forgotten that they were blaming the Conservative Party before.
Yeah.
So they've, and that's it's one of the side effects, if you like, of a government having the worst start I can literally remember any government in my adult lifetime having. I can't remember a party going from, what was it, the heave of a sigh of relief in the country.
Yeah.
That they got rid of us, and now they've got this they thought slightly dull, respectable but competent man as Prime Minister, and they are understandably sorely disappointed by everything that Labour's done over the past year. So they're just kicking out at the whole system at the moment, and Nigel Farage is riding that very effectively. But I do think that's a very different game from actually preparing to run a country. And as I say, the Kent County Council will be an interesting sign. One of the things we've seen since Reform took over Kent County Council is that they announced that Kent County Council was spending hundreds of millions on using consultants. And we rapidly discovered that, in fact, Kent County Council just ran the portal for every county council to put out external tenders. So this wasn't Kent County Council's budget. This was the budget of all the county councils. And understandably, they've gone quite quiet about that since. But if that's the level of competence they're bringing to politics in Kent, then A, God help all of us in Kent, and B, I think it shows that they're a million miles away from being ready for government.
Mm. If Kevin Badenoch came to you and asked you for advice about how to connect with voters, what would your advice be?
Stick to your guns and have vivid policies that illustrate your underlying pitch, because I think your underlying pitch is very good. I think what we haven't got at the moment are policies that say, okay, I get that. Looking back in history, Margaret Thatcher was all about personal freedom and responsibility, and council house sales were the perfect example of that. It was going to take power away from the state and give people something so that they could run their own lives. And the world has moved on in 40, 50 years. So, we need different types of policies. But actually, I think, to find, we sort of know that people care about the safety of their streets and the levels of policing and they care about immigration. But they also care about the health service, and they also care about the countryside and that kind of thing. And so we need an overall message with policies that illustrate that individual message. And it doesn't need to be very many of them, but a few of them hammered home non-stop is what I would recommend to Kemi and the party.
Damien Green, listen, thank you very much indeed for your time today, and hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
The government's latest U-turn on welfare has brought the Prime Minister's own future into question. First, there was a screeching handbrake turn on cutting the winter fuel allowance. Then Sir Keir decided to reverse ferret on the grooming gangs inquiry. And now he's U-turned on another, this time on welfare. Rob, do you think this is the beginning of the end for Sir Keir Starmer?
I would hesitate to say that specifically, like this is, you know, time a clock has started, then it's going to be the end caused by this. I certainly don't think it's very helpful to him. I think it's a mistake which he could have done without. All of these U-turns that you've mentioned are, many of them are avoidable, and he could have come out much better from this situation. I think there's a lot of people who are willing to say that it is the beginning of the end for their own personal gains. Kemi Badenoch is going to certainly try and paint this as Keir Starmer's out of control and, you know, has no backbone or no authority over his own MPs and all this sort of thing. But I think actually the reality is he's in a difficult position. I mean, the Labour MPs are going to say that. But I challenge anyone to try and do what he's trying to do and not face similar challenges.
Do you think the backbenchers are getting too powerful?
It's hard to say where the balance of power lies, really. Obviously, it's a devastating result. 49 Labour MPs are revolting against it so early on, you know, barely a year into his premiership. But ultimately, whether he can steer the ship back remains to be seen. It's a challenging piece of legislation and one that a Labour government is always judged on. Welfare, you know, is a staple part of any Labour government, past and present. Whether or not they will be able to work out the finer details and return later, or they push for a dead bill, I don't know.
It seems that the backbenchers have got a disproportionate amount of power, because basically if the Prime Minister or the Chancellor decides to do anything and they revolt, it seems that they'll cave in. Having said that, there's a lot of new MPs with very, very thin majorities and who are probably going to lose their jobs at the next election, and they've got nothing to lose. But on the other flip side of that, and you hear this quite a lot, and this is certainly something that Damien Green was talking about not so long ago, he was sort of saying that Sir Keir Starmer hasn't even met some of his MPs. And there was one MP on the telly the other night, so he said he only met Keir Starmer once in 6 years. And this was a bit of an old hand. And he doesn't vote very often. He doesn't often go to the lobby. He's voted no more than about seven times since becoming Prime Minister, and doesn't go into the lobby, mix among the MPs, say, how are you, can you, you know, is there anything I can get you, or squeeze a few elbows or whatever. He doesn't do that. So it looks like he's losing sort of his grip on the job.
The discussion of whether the backbenchers have too much power is an interesting one, in the sense of, I mean, for quite some time now, I mean, particularly since Tony Blair, definitely, there's been a sort of perception that the government always has absolute control over who's in its party, and it's only in very rare instances where MPs will rebel. But obviously the system is not, that's not the way it's supposed to work. That's just kind of a management style that has been quite popular because it produces governments that can deliver what they're going to say. An alternative way of looking at it is that these MPs, they're the opposite of sort of career politicians, in the sense of they'll do whatever the party tells them to do in order to, you know, advance up the ladder. You could look at this from a sense of, they, although the Keir Starmer, who is technically sort of their boss, is telling them this is what we're going to do, they're saying, well, my constituents wouldn't like that, so I'm going to do something different. So I think, although this is going to be definitely be painted as Keir Starmer has lost control and, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing and all the rest of it, an alternative view of it is this is exactly the system as it should be. The government tries to do what it wants to do, but, you know, if the MPs decide they don't want to do it, then they'll vote against it.
Sean, do you reckon that Rachel Reeves will put up taxes in the autumn when they all come back?
I can't see any possibility where she can't. I mean, there's such little fiscal headroom for her to operate in, that, and then the cash doesn't seem to be coming from any other sources. So I would be, you know, very, very surprised if she doesn't have to do that ultimately, which is a move that's not going to make them very popular. But just to touch on what Rob said, I mean, you know, the Labour Party, you know, it will now answer calls as to whether it needs to, you know, swerve back to the left of its party, and there'll be lots of left-ranking members in it calling for a such, but it was elected on a mandate of a more centrist government, and
but the whole thing was growth, wasn't it?
Was growth, but if it veers to the left and makes those decisions, there's no guarantee to be able to do that, and it doesn't seem to have the money to be able to finance some of those, you know, those big investment projects. So to come back to your point, it will probably have to be. I can't see any other possibility of raising that tax through, also other than raising taxes to create that revenue.
Well, and there's other sort of ways of raising cash that they've double backed on. But one of the central planks of their manifesto pledges was about smashing the gangs, and that's not going very well, is it? Within the first half of this year, it's already a record number, and they haven't smashed any gangs as far as anyone can see. So, you know, that's a manifesto pledge that's out of the water. That's what I'm saying, that there's no part of the whole policy agenda that they set out before the election that they've actually managed to deliver on. None.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, just playing devil's advocate on that point, I guess, you know, a lot of people want to see change and they want to see it quickly, right? That's always what people will do, especially when they vote in a general election and vote as overwhelmingly they did for this Labour government. But have they been given enough ample opportunity to do that? And some of the mechanisms where they would affect that change, will they be able to do it in the time frame that they've been given so far? Mm. I think it's the lack of any clear clarity as to that and the way it's been communicated. May what's not, you know, griping the public more. But, you know, they're going to have to make some more stronger moves soon, because we've already seen the discontent and what that's, created.
It's almost like it's a communication problem. They can't communicate the ideas to the public, and they can't even communicate with their black benches. So they're in a whole world of trouble. Folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Rob and Sean for their contributions, and to former Kent MP Damien Green, who joined us as a special guest. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. You can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.